Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, this is L.A. Steele. Tonight we're going to discuss George Santayana's Three Philosophical Poets essay, and part one of this series was last Thursday we discussed Lucretius, and the introduction to the program, to the series. Excuse me a second. Quite ready here. All right. For those of you who aren't familiar, well, you know, I'm going to suggest, because of the time factor here in our shows, I wanted to discuss Dante as fully as possible this evening, and in 1 hour is kind of almost impossible, but who begins? For those of you who aren't familiar with Dante, Dante was the poet who wrote the great work of the Inferno, the Divine Comedy, actually, and it was called the Inferno, Purgatorio, and the Paradiso. And the story begins with his ascension or descension into hell, all right, where he meets a Virgil, who is the great Roman poet, who is his spiritual guide, and guides him through the seven levels of hell, and then, of course, then he rose, and then he went into the Purgatorio. Now, of course, this were basically on a totally Catholic, tradition, of course, but Dante, being Italian and being influenced by the Catholic Church, but the great part about Dante is that in the Inferno, is not only is it a philosophical work, and it far stretches in it, incredibly imaginative work, but it's also a satirical work, as well as bridges the philosophical and the spiritual and the real, and like very few works have ever done, and so few poets have ever really been able to attain that level of brilliance that Dante, of course, is immortalized for. And we begin the section. In the Phaedro of Plato, there is an incidental passage of supreme interest to the historian. It foreshadows and accurately defines the whole transition from antiquity to the Middle Age, from naturalism to supernaturalism, from Lucretius to Dante, Socrates in his prison, is addressing his disciples for the last time. The general subject is immortality, but in a pause in the argument, Socrates says, "In my mouth I heard someone reading, as he said, from a book of Anaxagoras. The reason was the disposer and cause of all, and I was delighted at this notion, which appeared quite admirable, and I said to myself, if reason is the disposer, reason will dispose all for the best and put each particular in the best place. And I argued that if any desired to find out the cause of the generation or destruction of existence of anything, he must find out what was best for that thing. And I rejoiced to think that I had found in Anaxagoras a teacher of the causes of existence such as I desired. And I imagine that he would tell me first whether the earth is flat or round, and whichever was true, he would proceed to show the nature of the best and show that this was best. And if he said the earth was in the center of the universe, he would further explain that this position was the best and should be satisfied with the explanation given and not want any other sort of cause. For I could not imagine that when he spoke of reason as a disposer of things, he would give any other account of their being except that this was best. And these hopes I would not have sold for a large sum of money, and I seized the books and read them in a fast as I could, as fast as I could in my eagerness to know the better and the worse. What happened I had formed, and how grievously I had was disappointed. As I proceeded, I found my philosopher altogether forsaking reason for any other principle or order, for having recourse to air and ether and water and other eccentricities. Thus one man makes a vortex all around and studies the earth by the heaven. Another gives the air as a support to the earth, which is the sort of bread trough. Any power which is arranging them as they are arranges them from the best never enters into their mind, and instead of finding any superior strength in it, they rather expect to discover another Atlantis, or another Atlas rather, of the world who is stronger and more everlasting and more containing than the good. Of the obligatory and containing power of the good they think nothing. And yet this is the principle which I would fain learn if anyone would teach me. There we have the program of a new philosophy. Things are to be understood by their uses or purposes, not by their elements or antecedents, as the fact that Socrates sits in his prison when he might have escaped the Euboea is to be understood by his allegiance to his notion of what is best, of his duty to himself and to his country, and not by the composition of his bones and muscles. For reasons as we give to our actions, such grounds as might move to the public assembly to decree this is that, are to be given an explanation, the order of nature. The world is a work of reason. It must be interpreted as we interpret the actions of man, but its motives, by its motives. And these motives we must guess not by a fanciful dramatic mythology, such as the poets of old had invented, but by a conscientious study of the better and the worse in the conduct of our own lives. For instance, the highest occupation, according to Plato, is the study of philosophy. But this would not be possible for a man if he had to be continually feeding like a grazing animal with the nose to the ground. Now, to obviate the necessity of eating all the time, long intestines are useful. Therefore, the cause of long intestines is the study of philosophy. Again, the eyes, nose, and mouth are in the front of the head because Plato, says Plato, the front is the nobler side, and if the back would not have been the nobler side and the front side had the eyes, nose, and mouth been there. This method is what Molière ridicules in La Malade Imaginaire when the chorus sings that opium puts people to sleep because it has a dormant virtue. and the nature of which is to make the senses slumber. And all this is ridiculous physics enough, but Plato knew, though he forgot sometimes, that his physics were playful. What it is important for us to know, to remember, is rather that under this childish or metaphorical physics, there is a serious mortality, a morality. Rather, after all, the use of opium is that it is a narcotic. No matter why, physically, it is one. The use of the body is the mind, whatever the origin of the body may be. And it seems to dignify and vindicate these uses to say that they are the causes of the organs that make them possible. What is true of particular organs or substances is true of the whole frame of nature. Its use is to serve the good, to make the life happiness and virtue possible. Together, therefore, speaking in parables, Plato says, with his whole school, discover the right principle of action and you will have discovered the ruling force in the universe, and evoke in your rapt aspiration the essence of supreme good, and you will have understood why the spheres revolve, why earth is fertile, and why mankind suffers and exists. An observation must yield to dialectic. Political art must yield to aspiration. And it took many hundreds of years for the revolution to work itself out. Plato had a prophetic genius and looked away from what he saw, for he was Greek, to that to what mankind was to become in the next cycle of civilization. In Dante, the revolution is complete, not merely intellectually, for it had been completely intellectually long before in the Neoplatonists and the fathers of the church, but complete morally and poetically, in that all the habits of the mind and all the sanctions of public life had been assimilated to it. There had been time to reinterpret everything, obliterating the natural lines of cleavage in the world and substituting moral lines of cleavage for them. Nature was this compound of ideal purposes and inert matter. Life was a conflict between sin and grace, and the environment was a battleground between a host of angels and a legion of demons. The better and the worse had actually become, as Socrates desired, the sole principles of understanding. Having become Socratic, the thinking part of mankind devoted all its energies henceforth to determining good and evil in all their grades and in their ultimate essence, a task which Dante brings to a perfect conclusion. So earnestly and exclusively did they speculate about moral distinctions that they saw them in almost visible shapes, as Plato had seen his ideas. They materialized the terms of their moral philosophy into existing objects and powers. The highest good in Plato is still chiefly a political ideal. The aim of policy and art became God, the creator of the world. The various stages of elements of perfection became persons in the Godhead, or angelic intelligences, or aerial demons, or lower types of animal soul. Evil was identified with matter. The various stages of imperfection were ascribed to the grossness of various bodies, which waited and smothered the spark of divinity that animated them. This spark, however, might be released, then it would fly up again into its parent fire, and a soul would be saved. This philosophy is not a serious description of nature or evolution, but it was a serious judgment upon them. The good, the better, and the best had been discerned, and a mythical bevy of powers symbolizing these degrees of excellence had been first talked of and then believed in. Myth when another man was had invented it, can pass for history. And when that, and when this man is a Plato and has lived long ago, it can pass for revelation. And in this way, moral values came to be regarded as forces working in nature. But if they worked in nature, which was a compound of evil matter and perfect form, they must exist outside. For the ideal of excellence beckons from afar. It is what we pine for and are not. The forces that worked in nature were accordingly supernatural virtues, dominations, and powers. Each natural thing had its supernatural incubus, a guardian angel or a devil that possessed it. The supernatural, that is, something moral or ideal, regarded as a power and an existence, was all about us. Everything in the world was an effect of something beyond the world. Everything in life was a step to something beyond life. Into the system, Christianity fitted easily. It enriched it by adding miraculous history to symbolic cosmology. The Platonists had conceived a cosmos in which there were higher and lower beings marshaled in concentric circles around the vial of pivotal lump of earth. The Christian supplied a dramatic action for which the stage seemed admirably fitted, a story in which the whole human race or the single soul passed successively through these higher and lower stages. There had been a fall, and there might be a salvation, in a sense. Even this conception of descent from the good and ascent towards it again was Platonic. And according to the Platonists, the good eternally shed its vital influence like light and received through unawares and without increase of excellence to itself reflected rays that in the form of love and thought reverted to it from the ends of the universe. But according to the Platonists, this radiation of life and focusing of aspiration were not perpetual. The double movement was eternal. The history of the world was monotonous, or rather the world had no significant history, but only a movement like that of a fountain playing forever, or like the circulation of water that is always falling from the clouds in rain and always rising again in vapor. This fall or emanation of the world from the deity was the origin of evil for the Platonists. Evil consisted merely in materiality or otherness from God. If anything besides God was to exist, it had to be imperfect. Instability and conflict were essential to finitude, to existence, and to existence. Salvation, on the other hand, was a return current of aspiration on the part of the creature to revert to its source, an aspiration which was expressed in various types of being, fixed in the eternal types which led up like the steps of a temple to the ineffable good at the top. In the Christian system, this cosmic circulation became only a figure or symbol expressing the true creation, the true fall, and the true salvation. All three beings really exposed in an historical drama occurring only once. The material world was only a scene, a stage play, a stage setting, designed expressly to be appropriate for the play, and this play was the history of mankind, especially of Israel and of the church. And the persons and events of this history had a philosophic import. Each played some part in a providential plan. Each illustrated creation, sin, and salvation in some degree and on some particular level. The Jews had never felt uncomfortable at being material. Even in the other world, They hoped to remain so, and their immortality was a resurrection of the flesh. It did not seem plausible to them that this excellent frame of things should be done but a faint, troubled, and unintended echo of the good. On the contrary, they thought this would go good intrinsically, that they were sure God must have made it expressively and not by an unconscious effluence of his virtue, as the Platonists had believed. Their wonder at the power and ingenuity of the deity reached its maximum when they thought of him as the cunning contriver of nature and of themselves. Nevertheless, the work seemed to show some imperfections. Indeed, its moral excellence was potential rather than actual, and a suggestion of what might be rather than an accomplished fact. And so to explain the unexpected flaws in a creation which they thought essentially good, they put back at the beginning of things an experience they had daily in the present, namely that trouble springs from bad conduct. So this explains the good, the bad, and the ugly, if you will, of our existence, or it tries to explain it. And bad things happen because of bad conduct. Good things happen because of good conduct. The Jews were intent watchers of fortune and of its vicissitudes. The careers of men were their meditation by day and by night. And it takes little attention to perceive that frivolity, indifference, knavery, and debauchery did not make for well-beings in this world. And like other hard-pressed people, the ancient Jews had a pathetic admiration for safety and plenty. How little must have been known these things, how little they must have known these things, to think of them so rapturously and so poetically. And not merely their personal prudence, but their corporate and religious zeal made them abhor that bad conduct which defeated prosperity. It was not mere folly, but wickedness and the abomination of desolation. With the lessons of conduct continually in mind, they framed the theory that all suffering, even death, were the wages of sin. Finally, they went so far as to attribute evil in all creation, to the casual sin of a first man, and to taint it transmitted to his descendants, thus passing over the suffering and death of all creatures that are not human, and an indifference that would have astonished the Hindus. The imperfection of things in the Hebraic view was due to the accidents in their operation, not as in the Platonic view to their essential separation from their source and their end. It is in harmony with this that salvation, too, should come by virtue of some special act, like the incarnation or death of Christ. Just so, the Jews had conceived salvation as a revival of their national existence and greatness, so they brought about by the patience and fidelity of the elect, with tremendous miracles supervening to reward these virtues. Thus the conception of the fall and of the redemption was historical, and this was a great advantage to a man of imagination inheriting their system, for the personages and the miracles that figured in their sacred histories afforded a rich subject for fancy to work upon and for the arts to depict. The patriarchs from Adam down, the kings and prophets and the creation, Eden, the deluge, the deliverance out of Egypt, the thunders and the laws of Sinai, the temple in exile, the exile, all this and much more that fills the Bible was a rich fund, a familiar tradition living in the church on which Dante could draw as he drew at the same time from the parallel classic tradition which he also inherited. To lend all these biblical persons and incidences a philosophical dignity, he had only to fit them, as the fathers of the church had done, into the Neoplatonic cosmology, or, as the doctors of his own time were doing, into the Aristotelian ethics. So, interpreted, sacred history acquired for the philosopher a new importance besides that which it had seemed to have to Israel in exile or to the Christian soul conscious of sin. Every episode became the symbol of some moral state or some moral principle. Every preacher in Christendom as he repeated his homily on the gospel of the day, was invited to rear a structure of spiritual interpretations upon the literal sense of narrative, which nevertheless he has always to hold and preserve as a foundation for the others in a world made by God for the illustration of his glory. Things and events, true though real, must be also symbolical, for they're in tension and propriety behind them. The creation, the deluge, the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Christ, the coming of the Holy Ghost with flames of fire and gifts of tongue were all historical facts. The church was heir to the chosen people. It was a historic and political institution with a destiny in this world in which all her children should share and for which they should fight. At the same time, all those facts were mysteries and sacraments for the private soul. They were channels for the same moral graces that were embodied in the order of the heavenly spheres and in the type of moral life on earth. Thus, the Hebrew tradition brought to Dante's mind the consciousness of a providential history, a great earthly task to be transmitted from generation to generation, and a great hope. The Greek tradition brought him natural and moral philosophy. These contributions joined together had made Christian theology. So, essentially, here we owe much to Plato. As does the early Catholic Church and the later Catholic Church followed the laws of Aristotle, but also the concepts of Plato. And these great thinkers, just their influence is everywhere in our society. And they just, you know, just everywhere in the United States, the Republic, under what we are governed is a Platonic concept. You know, the mind and works of Plato can never be downplayed. As we go into, of course, the great works of these great works, but especially today's work with Dante. So anyway. Thus their conceptions of the fall and of the redemption was historical, and this was a great advantage to a man of imagination inheriting their systems and the personages and the miracles that figured in their sacred histories afforded a rich history of fantasy to work upon and for the arts to depict. And I mentioned this before. I wanted to reread that article because so much of the Jewish tradition plays into the Christian tradition, and yet all of these myths and histories and stories all become part and parcel of this strong and incredible religion called Christianity, as well as the history, the myths and histories of Muslim, of the Muslim race and the Jewish race. And you know, my God, it's on and endless and endless. And it's all myth, and it's all history, and some true, some not true, some made up. But nevertheless, it's a combination of all. And you have this hodgepodge of religious beliefs. And getting back to Dante, in Dante's work, we see all of this merging, you know, as we enter the pagan hell, you know, and then, you know, and Virgil is a pagan. He's not a Christian, so he can't go beyond purgatory. And, you know, it's only a Christian heaven. And, you know, there's a farce to this. That's why it's called a comedy. But there's a true believer's belief as well in this Christian concept of, you know, heaven and hell and purgatory and earth and, you know. I personally like to believe in incarnation, reincarnation. And I personally believe that we to come back and relive our lives and for things that we feel that we must do, experiences that we must have. That says a lot when you consider demonic entities like G.W. Bush or Hitler or, you know, Dick Cheney or, you know, these horrible, horrible people that exist to this day. To me, they're evil incarnate, you know, these people. And, but at the same time, I that's why I believe strongly that either they're demonic entities that need a host, you know, or they're just plain wicked human beings that know no limits to their ambition, know no limits to their cruelty, and they don't deserve the name human. They're not human. They're inhuman, and that's where you must cross the line. That's where you must draw the line in the sand between morality and, you know, immorality, and you know, the fact that you have government and the churches condoning murder and death and destruction and theft and taxes and, you know, just, you know, unbelievable immoral acts. Then what does that leave us, you know, as individuals? We have to look at, try to follow some kind of instruction as to what do these religions mean, what do these political systems mean, what am I trying to discern here, you know, why am I here? Am I here to serve the system, or am I here to serve myself and humanity? My answer years or more of my life, I'm here to benefit mankind. I'm here to benefit myself, to survive. But at the same time, if I can survive and help others to survive and thrive, then I've done my job here in whatever incarnation that I have. And, you know, as long as my work is toward the good, then according to Plato's concept, the good results will come of it. And I believe they will. Negative acts breed negative results. It's just, you know, you kill somebody, you know, it's not a good thing. And it'll come back and haunt you. You may wind up forever in a prison. But my strongest beliefs are that you are what you are by what you believe. And, you know, my beliefs happen to be liberal. They happen to be socially compassionate. They happen to embrace the essence of Christhood in man. These are the things that we must promote. These are the things that we must excel and achieve in our lives, which is understanding the intuitive, clairvoyant, and physical nature of our existence so that we can embrace the entire experience of being human, all right? And once that tires out, once the physical body can no longer tolerate the wear and tear of a third-dimensional state, then we, you know, move on to the fourth and fifth and sixth and hierarchy of dimensions until we can, you know, see God, which is our ultimate goal, you know. Our ultimate dream is to be in the presence of the great Creator, the Father of all. And what greater, I don't know, I mean, what greater honor can there be? And, you know, so that's what we strive for in our lives, to strive for that oneness with the universal consciousness. And when we achieve that, then we become poetic. We become poets. We speak the divine language. We interpret tongues. We are emotionally and intellectually on par with Him, with the Creator, and that gives us that joy and that splendor and that lack of care and pure love that we are capable of as a species. And so Dante, getting back to Dante, he saw this and definitely in the pity that you have for seeing the seven centers of sin, you know, the seven levels, and going through purgatory and then into heaven and seeing heaven through his eyes. And this is the ultimate state of existence for mankind in heaven. And we can understand that coming from the physical plane, what heaven would be, but to us, and to individually. But take that and extend it even further, further and further and further beyond your wildest imaginations, to the betterment of mankind, to the absolute perfection of man's existence. And that is Christhood. That is the ultimate goal that mankind must strive to achieve. And in that is pure, utter liberty, individual liberty, to decide and to be where there, to be there, to fully embrace the idea as an individual that God exists, that you as an individual can achieve Christhood, that you as an individual can achieve the perfect path that you as an individual can become an eternal being or are an eternal being, you know, and just finding your place. And when you pass away from the third dimensional realm, then you are transported. You transform your body and mind into the physical plane, into the fourth dimension, and again in the fifth dimension, and then in the sixth dimension, in the high, and in the many higher overtones and octaves there, to become an absolute complete individual and one with God. So that takes hundreds of thousands of years of evolution, and perhaps hundreds of different reincarnations, right? The soul to come back and work out the difficulty, work out the problems, work out the all of the problems they have, and hopefully they pass the course with goodness and with kindness and with as a service to humanity, and not side with the embezzlers and the criminals and the spies and the thieves and the murderers and the crooks and the, you know, the horrible individuals who think they actually run this world. They don't. They don't. We do. We have more and more power every day, and our power grows more and more every day as individuals, because we become more and more aware of that, of our power to imagine, a power to create, a power to live, grow, and be who we are. It can't be denied. Because mankind, even through his darkest days, even through his greatest wars and the greatest demonic individuals seizing power throughout the land, mankind has succeeded in overthrowing that element and off his back and striving again and striving again. It's like the ant who's stepped on, whose ant house is anthill is stepped on or attacked by some animal or something, and it all goes, you know, it all crumbles down, and all that work for it seems to be for nothing. But the little ant keeps climbing back out, one piece at a time, one piece at a time, one piece at a time, until the whole colony, you know, is rebuilt and is stronger than ever. And that is why. That's what we are. That's what the human mind and human being is. But we must see, as Dante saw, as Plato saw, as Lucretius saw, as, you know, both saw, the truth of man, of who he is, and what he is, and why he is. And once we reach that level of continuity in our grasp of who and what we are, then we have full acknowledgement of how to attain whatever it is we want, simply by reaching for it, simply by asking for it, simply by it coming to you, okay? With plenty of whatever social foibles there are, money or metals or whatever you're in trade, you find you'll have it. And, you know, all the conniving and cheating and stealing only gets you so far. Only will get you so far. Until the day comes when you'll be robbed, plundered, murdered, and destroyed because of your own greed. Greed of others. Hated. You'll be hated amongst men. I don't know. I mean, I don't know. You know, presently, permanently. The fame is foolishness. Anybody can be famous. Anybody be put on TV and become famous overnight. You know. But what fame is so fleeting and so empty without purpose, you know, without reality, without... And fame can be very, very cruel. Because, and very cold and impersonal, because it may put you there, but it may put you in the limelight, it may put you on a camera, but what people see is what they perceive. And if you do a lousy presentation, or that first 15 minutes of fame that you have, then you'll never be seen again. Or you'll lose it gradually or become worse off than when you had it. I'm not really getting off the path here. I'm more discussing the philosophical aspects of this, of Dante. But let me skip ahead a little bit and so interpreted sacred history acquired for the philosopher a new importance besides that which it had seen to have to Israel or in exile or to Christian soul conscious of sin. Every episode became the symbol of some moral state or moral principle. Every preacher in Christendom, and as he repeated his homily on the gospel of the day, was invited to rear a structure of homily on the gospel of spiritual interpretations upon the literal sense of narrative, which, nevertheless, he was always to hold and preserve as a foundation for the others. In a world made by God for the illustration of his glory, things and events, though real, must be also symbolical, for there is intention and propriety behind them. The creation, the deluge, the incarnation, crucifixion, and resurrection of Christ, the coming of the Holy Ghost with flames of fire and gifts of tongue, were all historical facts. The church was heir to the chosen people. It was an historic and political institution with a destiny in its world in which all her children should share and for which she should fight. At the same time, all those facts were mysteries and sacraments for the private soul. They were channels for the same moral graces that were embodied in the order of heavenly spheres and in the types of moral life on earth. Thus, the Hebrew tradition brought to Dante's mind the consciousness of a providential history, a great earthly task to be transmitted from generation to generation in a great hope. The Greek tradition brought him natural and moral philosophy. These contributions joined together had made Christian theology. And although this theology was the guide to Dante's imagination and his general theme, yet it was not his only interest, or rather he put into the framework or orthodox theology theories and visions of his own, fusing all into one moral unity and one poetical enthusiasm. The fusion was perfect between the personal and the traditional elements. Thus, throughout the Divine Comedy, meaning and meaning lurked beneath the luminous pictures of the poem. Besides being a description of the other world and of the rewards and punishments meted out to the souls, is a dramatic view of human passions in the life, in this life, a history of Italy and of the world, and the theory of church and state, the autobiography of an exile, and the confessions of a Christian and of a lover, sanctioned, conscious of his sins and of the miracle of divine grace that intervenes to save him. The subject matter of the Divine Comedy is accordingly the moral universe in all its levels, romantic, political, and religious. To present these moral facts as in a graphic way, the poet performed a double work of imagination. Thus he chose some historical personage that might plausibly illustrate such each condition of the soul. This person in some characteristic and symbolic attitude of mind and body, and in appropriate symbolic environment, to give material embodiment to moral ideas by such a method would nowadays be very artificial and perhaps impossible. But in Dante's time, everything was favorable to the attempt. He was accustomed to think of goods and evils as functions of a natural life. Sparks struck out in the chance shock of men which with things or with one another. For Dante, it was a matter of course that the moral distinction between might be discerned not merely as they arise incidentally in human existence, but also and more genuinely as they are displayed in the order of creation. And the Creator himself was a poet producing allegories. The material world was a parable which he had built on a space and in order to be enacted, and history was a great charade. The symbols of earthly poets are words or images. The symbols of the divine poet were material things or natural things and the fortunes of men. They had been devised for a purpose, and this purpose, as the Quran too declares, had been precisely to show forth the great difference there is in God's sight between good and evil. The Platonic cosmology, the concentric spheres were bodies formed and animated by intelligences of material various orders. The nobler an intelligence, the more swift and onward or higher was the sphere it moved. Whence the identification of higher with better, which serves absolutely to this day. And while Dante could not attribute literal truth to his fancies about hell, purgatory, and heaven, he believed by God on purpose to receive souls for these varying degrees and complexions, so that we had a poet imagination, unless it re-echoed divine revelation, was only human and not prophetic. Yet it was genuine and plausible imagination, moving on the lines of nature and anticipating such things as perhaps every man would. I kind of lost my spot here for a minute. I was kind of spacing out, thinking about Dante and the connection and his connections to the philosophical and supernatural elements that we play in part. And I can somewhat identify with Dante's struggle only because many years ago, in my 20s, I created an epic poem, if you will, similar to the Dante say in that sense that I went through heaven, and I went through the earth and into hell and found my way out again, okay? And in that spiritual or almost the channel text that I had, this was my 20s when this happened, it became a complete book written in iambic pentameter. And that was, you know, that mirrored not only Dante's work, but it mirrored Milton's work. And I was studying Milton at that time in Paradise Lost. And the brilliance of that poem, of Dante's poem, was how it created the order of the universe, its own order. Whereas with mine, with the way I looked at it, in Milton, he created the absence of order in the sense of the great battle between heaven and between Lucifer and his angels in heaven. And once they won, which they didn't really win, they were cast out, they found Earth and they populated Earth, took charge of Earth. And that's how we're today. And they were called the Anunnaki. But we can go into that at another time. But it's just how scientific finds have changed the myths and discredit the myths, and at the same time seem to enlarge and or enhance the myths, the other myths, or ones that seem to have more evidence to comply with the scientific method of explanation. So I'm going to end the story tonight, this tale tonight. We discussed Dante. And I'll say this, that no man, as Dante says, could hate his own soul. He could not at once be and contradict the voice of his instincts and emotions, nor could a man hate God. For if that man knew himself, he would see that God was, by definition, his natural good and ultimate goal of his actual aspirations. And since it was impossible, according to this insight, that our faculties should be intrinsically evil, all evil had to arise from the disorder into which these faculties fall, that too great weaknesses or strength in relation to one another. If the animal or part of the man has too strong for his reason, he falls into incompetence. Then it is into lust and gluttony, avarice, wrath, or pride. Incontinence came from an excessive ill-timed pursuit of something good, of a part of what nature aims at for good. Children, property, and character are natural goods. And these sins are accordingly the most excrucible and the least odious. And Dante puts those who have sinned through love in the first class of hell, nearest to the signs of sunlight. Nearest to the sunlight, or in the topmost round of purgatory. And nearest to the earthly paradise. And below the lovers in each case are the gluttons, where a northern poet would have been obliged to place his drunkards. And beneath these, again, are the misers, worse because less open to the excuse of merely childish lack of self-control, and so on. And I'm going to leave that with you, and I hope you can look that up, three philosophical poets, And next week I'll try to conclude this with Goethe and the work of Faust, rather, as his great play. And we'll end there. And I want to thank everybody for joining me tonight. You can join us tomorrow night when we talk with George Dixon. Right here at 8 o'clock, 8 to 9 o'clock tomorrow night. So thank you for joining, and have a pleasant evening tonight.